listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, the president kicked it out of the park, or knocked it out of the park is the correct baseball phrase. Can't conflate baseball and football, can you? Not only different games, different fan sets, different mindsets. You know, Democrats are more likely to like baseball and Republicans more likely to like football. I always thought that was interesting. It's like, Anyway, or at least that was the case 10 years ago. It's been about that long since I saw the statistics. One of the things that I've been saying on this show forever, and I keep confronting Republicans with this, conservatives with this, I keep saying, can you please identify for me one country that cut its way to prosperity? Has it ever been done in the history of the world? Please, just one. I think they're listening down at the White House. Here's the president last night.
Most Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, understand that we can't just cut our way to prosperity.
Bingo. Now, there was something that I thought was interesting. The actual prepared text of the speech says, after all, why would we choose to make deeper cuts to education and Medicare just to protect special interest tax breaks? How is that fair? How does that promote growth? Medicare and education, which are clearly things that Republicans are suggesting cutting. And when the president actually delivered this, and which means that this was written into the speech. This was not an ad lib, but it was not written into the speech that was handed out to everybody, which means that the change was made like an hour before there, in the very, very short period of time before this speech was delivered. Remember, he did not mention Social Security in the prepared text. Here's what he said.
Why is it that deficit reduction is a big emergency, justifying making cuts in Social Security benefits, but not closing some loopholes? How does that promote growth?
See, and that was inserted after all, why do we choose to make deeper cuts to education and Medicare? In other words, it was a sentence that was inserted that references Medicare and Social Security. And I'm not quite sure what to make of that. Was this like just really kicking the Republicans upside the head? Or Pete Peterson? You know, going after the Wall Street banksters and the billionaires who want to privatize Social Security and want to get their grubby little hands on that $2.7 trillion surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund, which is considered by Republicans to be part of our national debt. Oh, my God, it's a terrible thing. Or was it a early signal that we'll make some changes in Social Security like a chain CPI? I mean, when I heard that, I said to Louise, there's your chain CPI. This is the flag. So I just don't know. But in any case, I to the extent that I may have any criticisms or critiques of the speech last night, that's it. I mean, you know, everything else is, he called out the Republicans on their whole manufactured crisis thing. You know, oh my God, it's a debt ceiling. Well, you set that debt ceiling. Oh my God, it's a sequestration. Well, John Boehner, you said you got 99% of everything you wanted with a sequestration. Oh, my God, you know, these manufactured crises here, and you've heard me use that phrase over and over again here on this program. Here is the President of the United States last night.
So let's set party interests aside and work to pass a budget that replaces reckless cuts with smart savings and wise investments in our future. And let's do it without the brinksmanship that stresses consumers and scares off investors. The greatest nation on earth. The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next.
There you go. And he's right. He's absolutely right. Another point that I've made repeatedly on this program, and this is not to say that the president is listening to the show and writing his speeches. Not at all. It's just, I just think that, you know, these topics are, are just, it's like, this is like low-hanging fruit. I mean, this is the obvious stuff. I'm talking about it on the radio. He's talking about it in the State of the Union speech. Politicians all over the country are talking about it. Good progressives in particular, people like Peter DeFazio, Sherrod Brown, who's going to be with us later today. Now, Bernie Sanders is going to be with us tomorrow, by the way, instead of Friday. He's got to be in an airplane on Friday. And others are basically saying all these same things. And it's not even, I don't think, a matter of great minds think alike. I think it's a matter of, when the sun is up, everybody agrees it's daytime. For example, I have pointed out repeatedly, and where did my pocket constitution go? It has vanished from my desk. Oh, well. Somewhere around here. I'll do it from memory. I believe it's in the 14th Amendment. It's like the last paragraph of the 14th Amendment. And it says basically that no government agency can or shall question the full. There it is, right there. Question the full faith and credit of the United States of America. In fact, let me get the exact language for you here. The validity of the public debt of the United States, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. The validity of the public debt of the United States. Now, this, let me just pause for a moment. There's a hell of a history to this. When the American Revolution was fought, and we didn't have a government, we had what was a proto-government, a pre-government, which we referred to as the United States of America. But you'll keep in mind, I mean, the Treaty of Peace was signed in 1883. That's when we ended the war. The Constitution was proposed in 1783. The Constitution was proposed in 1787 or 86, ratified in 87, if my memory serves me right. And then the Bill of Rights in 17, or no, no, it was proposed in 87. It was ratified in 89. And the Bill of Rights was added in 1791. I'm pretty sure I'm right on those dates. But anyhow, the point is that when we fought that war, we issued bonds, debt, a lot of it to France, but a lot of it to people within the United States. A lot of Americans bought those bonds so that we could fight this war against the British. And after the government was created, when we were our operating under the Articles of Confederation, and then during the George Washington administration, when Alexander Hamilton was Treasury Secretary and Thomas Jefferson was the Secretary of State, those bonds came due, many of them. It was time to pay the bill. And Jefferson, and Washington was inclined to go along with Jefferson at first. Jefferson was saying, don't pay them at par. Don't pay, if it's a $100 bond, just say, sorry, we don't have the money to pay it, because we didn't. We were broke. We just fought a war. We were in shambles. Say, we'll give you 75 cents on the dollar. And Alexander Hamilton said, no, pay them at 100% of par. And he fought for that, and he won. And we paid off those war debts dollar for dollar. And as a result of that, the next time we issued debt, which was the next year of the George Washington administration, 100% of it was instantly sold and has been ever since then. It established the full faith and credit of the United States. So anyhow, back to the 14th Amendment, Section 4. The validity of the public debt of the United States, including debts, shall not be questioned. And basically, this is what the president said last night. Do we have time? Do we have 13 seconds? We don't. Okay, I will play this for you on the other side of this break. We'll be back. I'll play it for you in 4 minutes. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's important to put these things in context, that if we don't protect the full faith and credit of the United States from the Republicans, we're in deep trouble. Come back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, so, at various times I have ranted about this, about the 14th Amendment. Of course, the history of the 14th Amendment had to do with whether or not the Union was going to pay its bills and whether they were going to pay the bills of the Confederacy and all that kind of thing. And there was just this whole big debate. But nonetheless, it's part of our Constitution now. the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrections or rebellions, a.k.a. the Civil War, shall not be questioned. And then, by the way, you know, we're not going to pay the debts of the damn Confederacy. The next sentence, but neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States or any claim or the loss of for the loss of emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. So, you know, it really was about kicking the Southerners upside the head. But in the process, what it did is it put into the Constitution that the debt of the United States shall not be questioned, which is what the Republicans are doing. They're messing with the full faith and credit of the United States. They are saying, oh, you know, we got this debt ceiling that we passed way back in the 19-teens, you know, to try and keep us from going into World War I and all this kind of stuff. And now we never did anything with it. But now we could use it as something to beat up the president. And he called him. And you know, you've heard me rant about this for, what, years? Well, particularly the last year or two that the Republicans have been using this stupid, making this stupid argument that the debt ceiling was something other than just an arbitrary, made-up, manufactured number that Congress just comes up with every year to say, well, let's set that number. I mean, you know, three chimps and a dartboard would do a better job. Seriously. So here's what the president had to say about the full faith and credit of the United States and how the Republicans keep putting it under assault in, frankly, a way that I'm saying is unconstitutional and therefore, at the very least, un-American.
Let's agree. Let's agree right here, right now, to keep the people's government open and pay our bills on time and always uphold the full faith and credit of the United States of America.
Quote, end quote, from the 14th Amendment. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I just, maybe because there's so much of my language in this speech, and I don't mean my language. As I said, I don't for a moment think, although I do know that there are people at the White House who listen to this program, but I don't for a moment think that this makes its way into the president's speech. I just think this is obvious stuff. This is the low-hanging fruit. You know, the idea that, you know, I get these cons on. You've heard me debate this 50 times in the last 5 years, maybe 300 times in the last 5 years or the 9 years we've been doing this program. These cons go on and go, oh, we got a spending problem. We got to cut our spending. And I'm like, well, no, we've got a jobs problem. You know, what's the purpose of government? The government, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. What about the commons? An economic plan has to be comprehensive. An economy, people say, well, you know, it's my household. I don't spend more than I take in. If I did, I'd have credit card debt. Well, yeah, but that's it. You're a household. You're not a government. A, you don't issue the currency. And B, your responsibility is to keep your household going, not to support a nation. Austerity or cutting spending, deficit reduction, this is not an economic plan. It's got nothing to do with an economy. It's one small piece of a large math equation that has to do with here's how the government runs. And you've heard me say that over and over and over again. Here's the president saying it last night.
Deficit reduction alone is not an economic plan.
Thank you, sir. Bless you. You've heard me talking about the Permian extinction. Now, you know, the president didn't get into that last night. I did on TV, and I do on radio from time to time. You know, the Permian extinction was 250 million years ago when what is now Europe, the couple of continents that made up what is now Europe and Africa started splitting apart, and a large chunk of what is now Siberia, or Europe and Asia, actually, a large chunk of what is now Siberia was a lava field. And the temperature of the planet went up 5 degrees Celsius, which raised the temperature of the oceans 5 degrees Celsius, which melted the methane hydrate crystals, the frozen methane, the frozen dead sea vegetation, dead algae down at the bottom of the sea, not the bottom of the sea, along the coastal shelves, melted that methane, bubbled up into the air. Methane is 25 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So that, the greenhouse effect of that over the next 18 years caused the planet to raise another 10 degrees, another 5 degrees in temperature for a total of 10 degrees Celsius. And that killed 95% of all life on Earth and sea. And the scientists are now saying, you know, if we keep going on this current path by 2100, which is, what, 87 years from now? We're going to be 5 degrees warmer. And if we're 5 degrees warmer, I'm saying, and a lot of scientists are saying, the methane crystals are going to melt again, and we're going to be 10 degrees warmer. And if we're 10 degrees warmer, you're looking at another Permian extinction. What came out of the Permian extinction? 95% of all life on Earth died, and it took 80,000 years for life to even basically come back. And then it ushered in the age of the dinosaurs. Here's the president, clip number 5, talking about, hey, let's do this before it's too late. I mean, when I'm saying too late, I'm talking seriously too late. Here he is.
But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late.
Yeah. Before it's too late, because 95% of all life on Earth is too friggin' late. You get it? I mean, it's like the Permian extinction. BBC did this great documentary on the mammal. It's actually the MacGuffin. The storyline of it is that this one animal. It was a pre-mammal. It was like kind of part lizard, part mammal that survived the Permian extinction. That is literally the ancestor of every mammal on Earth. And it was on BBC Four about a year ago, sometime in this last year in 2012. And it's you can easily Google it. The whole 55 minutes of it is up on YouTube, and it will make your head explode. And it's what the president was talking about last week.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we'll see. I'm going to pick up some of your calls. We've got another 20 clips here, but let's get into a conversation about this as well, right after the break. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here, the place where despair is not an option. Not a chance. Okay, one last clip, and then I'll get to your calls. In fact, I even see I have somebody who disagrees with me. Oh, he dropped off. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. Tim, I'll be with you in just a moment. I have been saying for years that in the 1960s, in 61 through 65, when the minimum wage was, in today's dollars, about $10.15 an hour, that people who were working at the minimum wage, like me, I was making $2.35 an hour, which you can inflate that up to today's minimum wage. If today it'd be a little over 10 bucks an hour. I was making $2.35 an hour as a DJ at WITL, AM and FM, Lansing, Michigan. And pumping gas at an Exxon station and changing tires on weekends. And as a dishwasher, a cook, and for one whole day, a waiter at Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing, Michigan. All of those were minimum wage jobs. And I could pay my way through college. My parents kicked in not a penny. Well, I didn't finish college, but I mean, had I chosen to, I could have. Louise, my wife, was working as a waitress at Howard Johnson's. I think she was making less than minimum wage because she was, you know, she was getting tips. And you could pay your way through school. You know, back in the 60s. This was back in the late 60s, early 70s. Most people did. Student debt? Who ever heard of student debt? Unless you wanted to get an MD or something. You know, if you wanted to go to graduate school, student debt made sense. But 4 years? Easy. Why? Because the minimum wage you could live on. Well, here's what the president had to say about the minimum wage, clip number 9, last night.
Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on Earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
So there you go. And by the way, if that were to happen, it would be an enormous stimulus for this country. Because when you look back at the history of the minimum wage, every single time, going all the way back to 1935 when it was introduced, every single time the minimum wage has been raised over the next 3 years, what you see is a substantial increase in economic activity. Why? Because as anybody who's ever taken an economics course can tell you, demand is what drives economies. People wanting things, people buying and having the means to pay for them. And when you give more money to people, and I don't mean give as in a gift, when people who spend 100% of their income have a little extra income, whether it's the result of, you know, what Bernie Sanders suggested and George W. Bush did, giving everybody a $300, you know, one-time tax rebate back in 2001 or 2002 when they did that, or whether it's, you know, cutting the payroll tax, which Obama did last year, or whether it's raising the minimum wage, whatever it may be, when average working people who spend 100% of the money that they make, or damn close to it, when they have a little more money, they spend a little more money. When they spend a little more money, shopkeepers sell a little more stuff. And when they sell a little more stuff, they need to hire extra clerks. And they need to buy more stuff. And when they need to buy more stuff, the wholesalers need to deliver more stuff. And when the wholesalers need to deliver more stuff, the delivery truck people have to hire new delivery truck drivers. And the manufacturers have to gear up more manufacturing. As the manufacturers gear up more manufacturing, they need to buy more raw materials. And as they're buying more raw materials, the raw material suppliers have to hire by. And it's called this knock-on effect. It's called this with the multiplier effect. A dollar in spending over the course of 2 years can produce as much as $4 in an economy, regardless of where that spending comes from. Cash registers don't say, oh, is this a government dollar? You know, you walk into Macy's or McDonald's and say, you know, here's a dollar, you know, here's $2 or here's $20 or here's $200, whatever it is. And they're not going to say, oh, is that a government dollar? If that's a government dollar, we're not going to pass that along to our suppliers. That had to come from the private sector. Don't you understand? Government dollars don't increase the economy. I'm sorry. You know, Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, Paul Ryan, these guys, they may be well-intentioned. They're certainly well-funded by billionaires who benefit from people being ignorant about economics. But the simple fact of the matter is that if you want to stimulate the economy, which we need to do, we don't have full employment. The job of the government is to provide for full employment. That's not the job of capitalism. The job of capitalism is so people can make money. And full employment might happen and it might not. And more often than not, it doesn't. The job of government is to make sure that the people who are making money in a way that benefits society, which includes full employment. You want full employment, you stimulate the economy, by raising the minimum wage. And the president called for that. And my jaw dropped. I thought, how long have I been talking about this? And not just me. So, Tim, in Manassas, Virginia, you didn't like the speech, or you don't like what I'm saying, or what? It says you disagree with me. About what?
Well, I disagree. I mean, here's what I disagree with a lot of the process. I try not to get too broad here. I mean, I think we're about the same age. I'm 51 years old. I remember when I was working to go to college, Ronald Reagan pulled the rug out from underneath me when suddenly I had to start paying taxes on my tips. As a result of that, I couldn't pay for my college anymore. I had to actually go borrow money. So, you know, there is something for an honest day's work and an honest day's pay to get ahead. I fully understand that. Where we get into problems is when we start dumping regulations on top of that and we make different...
Actually, there's a really good study that came out yesterday from a business group that found that when regulations in general, I mean, you could find specific regulations, but in general, right across the economy, on an annualized basis over a 10-year period, as regulations went up, employment went up, and economic activity went up. If you say to a power plant, for example, you've got to do something about the sulfur dioxide coming out of your smokestack, a regulation, the kind of regulations that the Koch brothers hate, and so they pay right-wing think tanks to say regulations are bad, that coal-fired power plant then has to hire somebody to design and build that scrubber, which means that they have to hire people. Regulations create jobs.
Good point. But to a good point, Tom, we actually have proof of that. If you want to go back simple 10 years ago, look at TECO. That's the Tampa Power Electric Company. They have the first clean coal scrubber, and they're doing very well. Tampa was a dirty city. It's one of the cleanest now down there on the West Coast. And their production and their rate and their efficiency is up.
Right. So regulations help everybody.
But it paid off when we got bogged down in regulations where the left and the right and the left go back and forth at each other. The point I wanted to make is last night Barack talked about the manufactured crisis. And he's right. These guys manufacture crises. I don't really care if you're left or right. I don't think they represent us anymore. They represent their own political position.
Well, I do care if you're left or right, because I would submit to you, Tim, that there's a lot of people that you would call left who actually are representing us. The Jan Schakowskis and Sherrod Browns and Bernie Sanders of the world, the Peter DeFazios of the world.
You can say that's the same thing to the right. There are people on the right that represent you.
Please name one.
I agree with all the time.
But please name one.
What I'm going to try to say to you is this. When you
name one Republican who is representing the average working person in America.
One Republican who represents
the average working people in the United States by virtue of supporting those policies.
Well, he gave the rebuttal last night to President Obama.
Marco Rubio?
$100,000 student loan. Correct. Just paying off $100,000 student loan.
So you think that Marco Rubio represents the interest of the average working person? Marco Rubio is against increasing the minimum wage. Marco Rubio is in favor of voucherizing Medicare. Marco Rubio is in favor of privatizing Social Security.
We get back to the game of politics.
This is not a game of politics. Tell me one policy, please. If you think that... No, Tim, stop for a minute. Pause. Take a breath. Simple question. If you believe that Marco Rubio actually represents the interests of the average working person, could you please tell me one policy proposal that he supports that will benefit the average working person?
Well, I mean, the immigration policy that he put out before the election that Barack Obama borrowed is a perfect example about the DREAM Act and some of that. That's a perfect example of an open-minded guy.
The DREAM Act has been opposed by Marco Rubio.
No, he had his version of the DREAM Act before when Barack Obama put a temporary executive order in to help those kids, which I think is a good thing to do. If you came here and you had no way of getting, you had no idea you were here illegally, certainly shouldn't send you back. And I'm a conservative, and most conservatives I know, with a very big libertarian streak on that end, believe in that. The point I want to make is the optics, which is a new word around town these days, you have a president presently who previously called George Bush, and he wasn't my favorite guy, I'm not going on a George Bush tip, but he said he was un-American to take the debt, raise the debt ceiling, and to continue to borrow from the bank in charge was un-American.
Obama never called Bush un-American. Come on, Tim. You know that.
And he never once voted for a debt increase. He never once voted for the debt increase himself that he's asking for now. Now, my point is this. When you become the president, you realize all that stuff doesn't matter. You got to get it done. The problem is we continue to do that to ourselves. Sound bites come back and bite you. So how does it look when the president, only a scant few years ago, said, I would never do it. It's unconstitutional. I think that's what he said.
Never do what?
Now he's asking for it. It's confusing.
Raise the debt ceiling? No, he didn't say that. The debt ceiling has been raised by every president since it was put into place in the 1900s.
He said very clearly it was unconstitutional for George Bush to raise it and continue to borrow money from the Bank of China's credit card.
I'm sorry, would you just repeat your last sentence, Tim? I missed you. I was listening to something else. I'm sorry.
Okay. He said it was unconstitutional for George Bush to raise the debt ceiling and to borrow money from the credit card of China when he was running for president.
No, he did not say that.
He did not vote for the debt. He did. You can look it up online. I don't want to argue that point. My point is, it's those sorts, the environment that we created in Washington.
I think he said that the war was unconstitutional because there was no declaration of war. But frankly, okay, Tim, I get it. You want to play gotcha with these things. I'd rather talk about the broad policy issues, frankly. 45 minutes past, and we'll get back to that. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And did you see that 102-year-old woman who sat there for like 5 hours in order to vote, 5-6 hours to vote, because the Republicans want to make it harder for black people to vote? 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. And boy, are they out there. Gregory in Greenville, South Carolina. Hey, Gregory, what's up?
Hey, you were so right. I called. I'm going to talk about the voting thing, but I just want to briefly say you were so right about, the Republicans in recent history and even beyond, they never cared about the deficit until President Obama came into office.
Well, they cared about it when Clinton was in office too. I mean, this was a strategy that was put together by a guy named Jude Winiski back in 1976. He called it the two Santa Claus theory of when Republicans are running the country, spend like drunken sailors and run the debt up as high and hard as you can. And then when a Democrat comes into office, starts screaming about the debt and force them to shoot the Santa Claus that FDR created, a.k.a. Social Security.
Well, part of the problem we have is we were in a totally unnecessary, Iraq was a totally unnecessary war.
Yep.
Which run up the debt.
So was Afghanistan.
A whole lot.
So was Afghanistan.
And it's just, but briefly, I just wanted to touch on two things from last night's address, which I thought was spot on. I thought it was great. I was totally happy to hear about the minimum wage because I work a 40-hour job and I make a little more than minimum wage. But I'm working 40 hours a week on a very fixed income. And it's frustrating that the minimum wage hasn't been raised in a long time, and $9 an hour. I'm so happy for that. I'd rather have $10 an hour. But I know that Republicans are gonna block this, and they're gonna block this every step of the way. But my next point is, I really was happy to see, I believe her name was Desaline Victor, or she was the lady from Florida who waited, she's 102 years old, and she waited in line for, I don't know,
6 hours.
Four or five hours, yeah. 6 hours. A long time, because I thought that was so great because she remembers the day when she could not vote, and she also stood up because the Republicans, in a lot of ways, are going back to pre-1964 Voting Rights Act. They're trying to do all these shenanigans to keep people from voting, and it's such a great thing when somebody 102 years old and she's in line that long to vote. I think
God
that's great.
Her. Yep, I totally agree with you, Gregory. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You know, earlier you said you think the White House speechwriters are listening to the Tom Hartman program, and I have to agree.
Well, what I said was I don't think they are. I do know that there are people in the White House who do listen to the show. I've gotten that feedback, but I don't think that they sit around taking notes.
Listen to this. Give me a minute to explain this.
Okay.
Is the media and, you know, MSNBC and the New York Times, they're all missing this, and I think the speechwriters are hoping that they pick up on this, that Obama is trying, both in his inaugural address and in last night's address, he's trying to define what democracy means and untangle this nonsense that, you know, the cons keep saying, and even today they said, oh, it was just another ode to big right. government, less liberty and all this. And Obama keeps using the word citizenship. And if you remember, the last paragraph last night was all about defining what does the word citizenship mean. And in his inaugural, he kept saying, we the people, and he kept saying, my fellow citizens. So he keeps trying to explain that in our democracy, government is not outside of us. It is we are the government. It's not an alien force.
Yeah,
and we are citizens before we are consumers. And he keeps trying to untangle this. And I'm so surprised that the media has missed this. With this beautiful paragraph on what citizenship is.
Yeah, and Tom, I don't have that clip right now, but we'll be looking for it. But here's a little piece that's pretty close to it. This is clip number 15.
Well, I can read it to you.
No, hang on just a second. Here, listen to this.
This country only works when we accept certain obligations to one another and to future generations. That our rights are wrapped up in the rights of others.
So there you go. I mean, this is essentially.
You want me to read the last paragraph?
Sure. Well, actually, no. Let me get the audio for it, and I'll play it in the next hour because I'd
love to hear. All right. Because it's when he was looking at that guy from Wisconsin who said I'm just made this way when he got shot like 12 times.
Yeah.
You remember right at the very end?
Yep. Yep.
And he says we are made different. He goes into this riff about what citizenship is, and he did this in the inaugural about we the people.
Yeah.
And today, the con radio is all over big government, and his speechwriters anticipated this thing about government, and he keeps trying to define what is our government.
That's right. And our government is we the people, the first three words of the Constitution.
Democracy. We're not a totalitarian force outside. You know, it's amazing.
No, you're absolutely right. And this is the question. The two big questions of our day are, what is government? Is it them out there that we should be stockpiling guns against and freaking out about and trying to drown in a bathtub? Or is it we the people? That's the first question. And then the second question is, what is the purpose of government? And I think that President Obama last night answered both those questions, and he answered them in the classical large L liberal tradition, and or small L in the American usage, not the European usage, which was the same tradition of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Jack Kennedy. And frankly, Dwight Eisenhower, I can give you a list of Republican presidents as well.
Justice Brandeis, his quote when he said, we either can have concentrated wealth or democracy, but we can't have both.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just amazing how, you know, we are citizens before we are consumers, because the cons want to believe that our government is actually capitalism.
Yeah, no, and it's not. And that's Ayn Rand's, you know, pitch is, you know, capitalism is a form of government. She didn't understand. And I love this quote that you sent to me, Tom, I believe, from John Kenneth Galbraith. I've got to print it out hanging on the wall here. The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness.
Exactly.
And that is the cause for the existence of the Republican Party these days, is to find. Go ahead.
No, you should go ahead and play that, the last paragraph, how he closed the speech about citizenship.
Yeah, well, we're flat out of time here now, but we will get to it. And thank you, Tom, for the heads up.
Yep.
And much appreciate the call. So, you know, again, I don't think that they're taking notes over at the White House. But I do think that the Times, to the extent that this show and my thinking reflects the Times or might have some small influence on the Times, but I think, frankly, reflects the Times. I think, you know, we're all part of this parade. We're all part of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the Times. And the president is attuned to that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve Keen is on the line with us, the Australian economist, professor of economics and finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of Debunking Economics, his website, debtdeflation.com. If you go there, there's a link both to his upcoming work, but also to his regular blog. And on his blog, he is crowdsourcing a project called Minsky, which we will learn about. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Or Dr. Keen, I guess I should say. Professor Keen. First of all, tell me about Minsky. Why are you trying to raise, you know, money to produce what is this?
It's a software package that's designed to do dynamic monetary modeling of the economy. Now, that might sound bizarre because that's what people think, oh, don't economists do that already? And the answer is no. The neoclassical school that dominates the discipline completely ignores the existence of banks, debt, and money in their modeling, completely ignores it. And they work as though the economy is always in equilibrium, which means everything's nice and balanced and roll and rest rather than up and down, as we actually know the real system is. So right. I'm developed a way of modeling banks very easily in a dynamic model, and that's what Minsky is. And of course, I can't get funding from it for conventional funding bodies because they all send my research proposals to neoclassical economists. So I'm going to the public instead.
So you're doing a Kickstarter campaign on this. I wish you well on that.
Thank you.
And our viewers and listeners can check that out over at debtdeflation.com. Professor Keen, tell us about, first of all, I've been talking on the program some about modern monetary theory and some of the core premises of it. And I understand that you have some disagreements with that. Could we start out with your points of contention with MMT and then maybe use those as ways to expand the conversation? I'm just looking for starting points here.
Yeah, Sure. Well, I'll start by saying that, first of all, what I have in common with modern monetary theory is that we are both monetary. We're both attempting to build a model of the economy as a monetary system. Now, as I've said, it's bizarre that conventional economics completely ignores banks, debt, and money. And I'll use my favorite quote on that when I had a battle with Paul Krugman. Krugman said back to me, he said, Keynes says it's essential to have banks in macro models. He said, I'm all for including banking. This is Paul Krugman. I'm all for including banking in stories where it's relevant. But why are they so relevant to a story about debt and leverage? Now, that should make everybody on the planet guffaw, but that's
because the debt is held by the banks or is generated.
Yeah, banks create the debt, and by creating debt and financing asset bubbles is what gives us crises like we're in right now. Right. So, of course, you have to include them there. And so modern monetary theory is taking one approach to that, and I'm taking a different approach. And if you like, it's a bit like the old story, The Blind Men of Hindustan. One person's grabbed the leg and somebody else has grabbed the trunk, and we're trying to actually define the elephant.
Okay.
Now, what the modern monetary theory group have done is they've looked at what they call vertical money. And they talk about how the government is one of the two manners in which you can create money in a market economy.
Right. With a fiat currency. Now, if I may interrupt you from time to time, in 1971, Nixon took us off the gold standard, and so we became pure fiat currency. The U.S. government, the Australian government, for that matter, is the issuer of the currency, arguably, and we can talk about the role of Fed in this. But Well, continue with what you were saying. I'm sorry.
But that's a good point. The emphasis that modern monetary theory has had is that in that change between what was an attempt at making money into a commodity-backed currency, the old gold standard,
right,
to what we have today, which is fiat money. And they say, with a fiat money system, there is no gold you're going to run out of. Therefore, the government is capable of producing as much fiat money as it wishes to. It's not constrained. It doesn't need to pay.
Well, it is constrained by things like inflation and employment.
And that's where we come back to saying, okay, once you've said a statement like that, let's see what those actual non-physical constraints are. I agree.
Right.
That's part of what should be the development of modern monetary theory going forward. I'm coming in from the side and saying, well, the other way you can create money in a capitalist economy is by banks creating the money.
That's right.
And we need a combined theory of the two. So I've been building the private theory. They've been building the government theory. Now, of course, in that case, it's a bit like they're saying the elephant is a snake and I'm saying it's a tree. I think we'll finally come together.
You're both talking about the elephant, right? Isn't it true though that in the United States, and I'm sorry, I don't know anything about Australian macroeconomics, but in the United States, the vast majority of what we'll call, I would call functional money. I'm sure there's a real name for it, base money or something like that. But the actual money that's circulating in the economy that ends up in the hands of consumers is not being created by the Fed. That money is going into and coming back out of banks. It's basically circulating the banking economy. You know, that trillions that they created during the crash in 2008, for example, never saw its way into the hands of consumers unless banks deigned to loan it to people. And even then, they didn't need to take it from the Fed. But on the other hand, the money that's circulating in the private economy is a function of banks because banks loan money into existence. So aren't there kind of two different geysers of money here? And one is, you know, the giant one is really the government one. It has the potential to be the giant one to really drive things, to take us to full employment. But because we're all operating in this kind of pre-71 mindset, our governments don't do this because they're afraid that it'll cause inflation or something. And then the other one is the smaller one is the banks, you know, loaning money into existence. And they don't do that smart or efficiently because they're always looking for maximum profit for banks, not maximum benefit for society, because that's the job of government. Am I making sense?
Well, in fact, close, but you've got your magnitude the wrong way around. By far, the biggest creator of money in the system is the private banking system. Now, if you look at the
functional system.
Let's talk about credit money and fiat money.
Okay.
And fiat money, the government's creation, was until the crisis hit far less than 10% of the total money supply.
Right.
Credit money was far more than 90%. Now, when Bernanke hit the taps during the financial crisis, he changed the ratio quite significantly.
Right.
But still, the majority of money that's created in the system is created by the private banking sector.
Okay. Thanks.
And we have to understand the dynamics of that. Now, where I do have a difference with MMT at the moment is an emphasis on saying that even if the government did try to create more money by fiat money created spending that could be underdone by what the private sector was doing in terms of deleveraging, where the private sector is trying to reduce its debt levels. So you need to actually have a combined analysis that looks at both those issues.
Right. So if the private sector pays off debt or increases savings, that actually takes money out of the economy.
Yeah. And so basically, if you can be trying to pour, it's like having a bathtub with two taps and two plugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to pour extra money and you've shut one plug and you've turned one tap on full blast, it doesn't help with the others dribbling, and then the other plug is wide open.
Right.
So you have to look at both sort of systems. So that two taps and two plugs bathtub analogy is a good way of looking at our system overall. Now, the point MMT is making, which is quite valid, is the government saying, oh dear, there's not enough money coming out of the private tap. Let's turn ours off as well. That's crazy. So if the private sector is dribbling money in, then the federal should be compensating. Otherwise, the cash in the economy goes down, that bathtub
even
drops,
if it, even
and
if
we all start losing jobs.
And the government should be doing that, even if it means that we, quote, go into debt. Right.
Yeah, because if you, again, looking at the level of debt's another remarkable thing. People need a bit of realism here. I gave a talk to Congress when I was there in December, and I talked about what I call the Rock of Damocles, which is my description for the level of private debt overhanging the American economy.
Right.
Everybody's worrying about the level of government debt, which is approaching the level of GDP, $14 trillion.
Right.
It's terrifying, of course. Take a look at private debt, guys. It's $38
trillion. $38 trillion?
$38 trillion.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S. It was $42 trillion. Debt has fallen by $4 trillion over the period of the financial crisis, but it's been flatlining at $38
trillion. Steve, can you stick around with us for a bit?
Yeah, sure, mate.
Great. Hang on just a minute. We're talking with Professor Steve Keens of Economics and Finance at Western Sydney University. Hang on just a second here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His website is debtdeflation.com. Get over there and click on his blog and go over to his Kickstart Minsky thing and help him out. This is a great project. Professor Keen will be back. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Sane Among Us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with Professor Steve Keen, Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney in Australia, the author of Debunking Economics. His website, debtdeflation.com. Be sure to click over to his blog and get to his Kickstart Minsky Now project. It's a really good one. His Twitter is Prof. Steve Keen. It's spelled K-E-E-N. And Professor Keen, you pointed out that while our national debt is pushing $14 trillion, and arguably you could pull almost three out of that as, you know, Social Security money we owe ourselves and other things like that. But nonetheless, there it is. $14 trillion, that the debt level of private debt in the United States, I'm assuming that is household debt plus corporate debt, is $38 billion, did you say?
No, $38
trillion. $38 trillion, thank you, yes.
More than 2.5 times the level of government debt.
Right, and so historically, what has that been relative to government debt? I mean, historically, like as in over the last, since World War II anyway. And what constrains that, or what should be done about that if it's a problem?
It's a problem. A certain amount of debt is necessary for an economy to function because people borrow money to invest in new factories. They borrow money to buy cars and houses they can't afford to buy out of their weekly paychecks. So there's two legitimate reasons to borrow money. And I think if you look at the American economy, the amount of entrepreneurship that goes on there, you need a substantial amount of debt, more so than the Australian economy, to finance entrepreneurial investment. So sure. I'd say that means a debt level of about 50 to 75% of GDP is probably a sustainable and sensible level in the American economy.
And in the private sector.
Private sector debt.
Right.
The American debt, private sector debt after the Second World War began at 45% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And it's risen, couple of ups and downs, but it's risen to 303% of GDP at its peak and is now down to about 250% of GDP.
Was there an exponential increase of this post-Reagan as opposed to a slower increase pre-Reagan? Because I know he changed so many policies that had to do with banking and debt or is this has been just a continuous trend ever since World War II?
It's a continuous trend. To me, it's a bit like having a pot, which is getting, you know, you're getting hotter and hotter, and you simply turn up the pressure at which right. beyond which the pot won't explode all the time, where you remove constraints to enable it to continue growing, right. and then finally explodes and bursts. So the trend is fairly constant all the way through from 1945 through to 2009, and then it falls off a cliff. And that's the real cliff you face. It's a debt cliff, not a fiscal cliff.
It falls off
a
cliff. You mean it actually, the debt level increases, right?
Falls, no, collapses.
Oh, it collapses.
When you borrow, a major part of my analysis, and this is actually where a lot of economists believe I'm doing double counting, and they are wrong, I am right. It's a it's a simple idea when you hear it to a public, but an economist will often end up doing a piece of logic that leads them astray. But if you imagine the amount of spending you can do, it's the sum of what you earn and what you in your new borrowing.
Sure.
So your total spending is your income plus your change in debt.
Right.
Now that because the banks can create money by creating debt, and they can, it's a double entry bookkeeping process for them to do it, that aggregates through to the national level. Your increase in debt doesn't mean somebody else has less money to spend. It's more money being created. So total spending in the economy is the sum of income plus the change in debt. Now when that's going on and the change in debt is rising, then of course there's more economic activity both in goods and services markets and also stock markets and housing markets.
Right.
Everybody feels good, but it relies upon that debt continuing to rise compared to income. Now at some certain point, as we saw in 2009, it becomes impossible to service the debt because you've got to pay the debt out of income. That's the catch.
Right.
You get a certain point where people can't do that anymore, more people lose money, the debt stops rising, and then you plunge off the real cliff, the debt cliff. And that began back in 2008 when people stopped increasing debt.
Right, and therefore the economy slows down because debt is decreasing, income is remaining the same, and therefore economic activity is decreasing. If you were to model this, tell me if this metaphor makes any sense. You familiar with the game of musical chairs?
Oh yeah,
you got a bunch of chairs. Yeah. Everybody's as long as the music is, everybody's walking. The music stops, and you pull one chair out, and somebody's stuck without a seat. Essentially, the debt service seems to me, the interest on that debt, which is going to the banksters, it seems to me like that's the missing chair in musical chairs. In other words, as we are constantly adding more debt, we're also adding more interest that has to be paid, and there's no way to put that interest back into the economy, or am I missing something?
You're missing something, but you've got one point which is right, another point is caught up in one of the problems in the way people think about this. People think if you borrow $100 from a bank and it charges you 5% interest, you borrow it 100, you've got to pay back 105, how can you possibly do it? That's a logical error because when you borrow that $100, that's a stock of money. It then can turn over several times in a year. You might make, say, $300 worth of transactions out of that money and buying and selling goods and services. You might make pay wages for, say, $250, make $50-something profit and pay $5 to the bank. It's quite easy to do.
Right.
But that's when you're doing it with income and making goods and producing goods and services and having real turnover in the economy. If instead you are speculating on the rising price of a house, then you're not actually selling the house. You're accumulating the debt until you sell the house.
Right.
And then you can pay the system back so long as the house price has risen. But it's actually rising levels of debt that's causing the house price to rise.
So in a manufacturing economy, it's safe. But in a fire economy, a finance, insurance, real estate economy, where it's driven by debt, then it is more like a game of musical chairs.
Exactly. And we've been playing the game of musical chairs in the fire economy. Really, it took over the economy pretty much back from 1966, and it's just been getting worse and going up and down in various ways. Certainly from 93 on, it's been all musical chairs, with first of all the dot-com bubble and then the housing bubble.
So what do we do? We have less than a minute left. I'm sorry.
I think the only way out of this is to abolish the debt. And you can't do it in a way that damages savers. It'd be innocent right. bystanders, in effect. Okay. So I talk about what I call a modern debt jubilee, to use that fiat money capacity of the government to pay off a large amount of the private debt, but to benefit savers at the same time.
So basically say, we're going to pay off all mortgages and student loans?
And give people money who weren't in debt as well.
And instead of creating that money out of the banks and the private sector, you create that money out of the government and the public sector.
That's right. And then get rid of the mistake we made.
Amazing. Professor Steve Keen, Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, debtdeflation.com. Please go there. Sir, thank you for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It has been great talking with you, Professor Keen. Thank you again.
Whereabouts are you based, Tom?
We're based in Washington, D.C. Hang on just a second. I got to put you on hold here. Hang on. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're going to continue this process of basically Econ 101. I'm committing this program and myself to learning macroeconomic, you know, big scale, large scale. How does it work? How do governments work? How do banks work? How does it all fit together? What does it all mean? We've been hearing these sound bites for so long and believing them to be true when most of them, in fact, aren't. Well, actually, you know, Dick Cheney did say deficits don't matter. In fact, what he said was we learned from Ronald Reagan that deficits don't matter. Turns out, to a certain extent, he was right. Never thought you'd hear me say that, did you? Dick Cheney was right. yes, quick, put it on YouTube. but I, you know, Professor Steve Keen is you know, one of the great minds in this field. There are a number of others who we're going to be featuring as you and I together learn macroeconomics and continue to figure this stuff out. As opposed to, and Jim, your mic is open. As opposed to, you know,
what are we going to do? Spending is a problem. Or, you know, all this nonsense that is coming out of Washington, D.C.,
or at least other parts of Washington, D.C. I realize some nonsense comes out of this show, but anyhow, you get the point. Back to the State of the Union. Clip number 8, I want to get to this. I just going through the State of the Union address, I keep finding things that I have done as hour-long rants being boiled down into two-sentence pieces by the President of the United States. And I'm just so pleased to see that these issues are being addressed. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean they're going to turn into legislation. It doesn't even necessarily mean he's going to be able to, you know, take names and kick butt and get things done. Although, looking at the headline on TPM today where he's like, no, John, you know, he's actually going raising the minimum wage is not going to hurt small businesses or any kind of business. It looks like he's actually going to go to the mattresses. He's going to fight for this stuff. And, you know, I probably shouldn't use mafia metaphors, but, you know, you get the point. And so here is the president talking about, you know, you'll recall yesterday when I did my State of the Union address, I said, you know, there's these four major infrastructures: transportation, energy, communications, and education. And the first one I went through was education, our educational infrastructure. We built a massive educational infrastructure in the 1950s when people like my dad, who'd come back from World War II, were given the ability to go to college for free, vis-a-vis via the GI Bill. And that educational infrastructure paid off in the invention of the transistor. Now, this was also government investments, by the way, from the space race and all this kind of stuff. You know, this was John Kennedy funding, you know, the apocryphal story is everything from the transistor to Tang, right? Tang turns out had nothing to do with the space race, but they tried to market it as if it did. But the point is that investment in the 50s in our educational infrastructure produced an explosion of innovation and invention in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that threw America to the front of the world. We put men on the moon. We created the internet. We created computers. It all happened here because we had invested in our educational infrastructure in the 1950s. And here's the president suggesting, you know, using his language, not mine, but this is clip number 8, that our educational infrastructure is damn important stuff, and we've been ignoring it ever since Ronald Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the Education Department. Bill Bennett, who ran for president the year before on a campaign of doing away with the Education Department. Ronald Reagan, who ended free college education in California. Becoming president of the United States and basically helping end free college education across the United States. We have been ignoring our educational infrastructure for 32 years now. It's insane. We've got a nation that is massively in debt as a consequence of this. We've got to do something about it. We've got to make college affordable. People have to be able to get to college. Clip number 8.
But taxpayers can't keep on subsidizing higher and higher and higher costs for higher education. Colleges must do their part to keep costs down. and it's our job to make sure that they do. So tonight, I ask Congress to change the Higher Education Act so that affordability and value are included in determining which colleges receive certain types of federal aid.
There you go. There you go. I mean, you know, it's a start. And I thought it was actually a decent start. You don't get everything you want overnight unless there is a screaming crisis. I mean, literally, the fire department doesn't come and pour water on the house unless the house is on fire. Otherwise, you go down to the fire department and you go down to the fire station and say, can you help me get a fire extinguisher here for my kitchen so I can just be ready in case, that kind of thing. But step by step. So, Steve, in Haymarket, Virginia, you wanted to comment on the president's comments about global warming. Steve? Steve, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio in Haymarket, Virginia? Steve has been on hold for too long, I think. He's...
Hello.
Oh.
Sorry.
That's quite all right.
Hello.
Why'd you have the mute button on? Hey, Steve.
Still there.
Okay. You're on the air.
All right. Yeah, I've got all the air monitoring reports in Virginia since 1976, and I've studied this for a long time, and I have yet to find anybody who's got any credible information to support the rumor of global warming.
Based on the air monitoring reports in the state of Virginia?
Well,
you're measuring the entire planet based on Virginia since 1949?
Well, Virginia is the hottest place on the planet. So that's another little point. But I've talked to Bob Carter from Australia, Willie Soon. I've talked to and I forget his name, I apologize, the economics professor from Spain, who, pretty much detailed the fallacy of green energy. It basically failed. And all we need to do is look at the material data sheet on lithium, lithium oxide, and lithium hydride. The end result of
so let's widen the lens here a little bit, Steve, if we can.
Okay. All right.
Why would all these scientists all over the world, the vast majority, and by vast majority, I'm not talking about 51%, I'm talking about 99%, and I'm sure you would acknowledge this. Of actual climate scientists, why are they?
That was a fraud. That was a
freaking out at us. Well, it's a fraud and it's a flawed study. Why would they do that?
Because they get money.
Most of these guys work for a salary. They work for universities.
Right.
They would get the same money whether they said global warming was coming or whether they said global cooling was coming or whether they said everything's just cool. Why would
they've been doing this for, like I say, I've been studying, I actually studied from a physicist.
But I mean, we can document, hang on just a second here, Steve, we can document hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades that have been given by oil barons, oil billionaires, and oil companies to think tanks and people who are not scientists, people like Mark Morano, who's a regular guest on this program, to run around the world saying there ain't no such thing as global warming. Don't worry. Carbon is not a pollutant. Carbon dioxide is wonderful. It makes trees grow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because they're in the business of taking 600-million-year-old carbon out of the ground and putting it into the atmosphere and making a profit doing that. I understand somebody wanting to jigger science when they are the most profitable corporation in the world. ExxonMobil last year, $40 billion profit, didn't pay a damn penny in U.S. income taxes. I understand them saying, okay, we'll take, a half a percent and we'll use that to make sure that nobody diminishes our profitability. I don't understand why somebody who's a tenured professor at a major university who studies this stuff for a living, whose paycheck is going to come whether they publish papers or not and whether they're worried or not, would say, I'm worried.
Well, that's the whole point. In other words, most of your environmental groups are funded by oil companies. What a policy.
No, they're not.
Restrict oil companies. They increase the value of oil. We don't really need to have oil valued this high, other than the fact that their opposition groups are formed by the oil companies
So you think that the oil companies created the Greenpeace?
Indirectly, yes. It's documented. It's not like I'm making this up.
And Greenpeace is somehow influencing scientists to come up with phony science so that the price of oil will go up, so that the oil company can make more money, so that they can then finance more and give more money to Greenpeace.
Right, exactly. And then the most classic example is Julian Simon, the University of Maryland.
Julian Simon is dead.
I realize that, but they waited until after he died to try to kill his credibility.
Oh, no, I used to criticize him when he was still alive. I remember when Julian Simon was still alive. He wouldn't come on our program. But in any case, Steve, thank you for sharing your perspective with us. It's fascinating. I appreciate the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is called the Give Them Enough Rope Theory. Welcome back. We'll be right back. Stick around. You know what I thought was the most interesting part of the State of the Union Address last night? I thought the most interesting part of the State of the Union Address was watching John Boehner's face. I couldn't tear my eyes away from it. It was like, you know, he would bite on his lip. He would roll his eyes. Occasionally he would feel like he had to clap. There are other times that he would feel like he had to frown. I mean, just the whole thing was fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is on the line with us. Ellen, I'm guessing you and your folks were there.
Human being that looked like the Speaker of the House.
I beg your pardon?
Were you talking about the ghost of the human being who's also known as the Speaker of the House last night?
Yeah, or the carrot wearing a suit, whichever it is.
I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Yeah. How so?
You're right. He looks like a cartoon of himself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he looked like he was having a really hard time, because here's a very popular president speaking very solid truths that are very unpopular in the Republican Party and yet are very popular among the American electorate, and Boehner knows he's on camera.
And his numbers went way up after that speech last night.
The president, of course. Of course. And Marco Rubio is still... he's turned himself into a national joke by grabbing that glass of water. That's so sad. You know, I heard somebody say this morning, if this guy can't go 15 minutes without a sip of water, how do we expect him to take that 3 a.m. call and sit in the Situation Room for an hour and a half while he's watching Bin Laden get killed?
Yeah, he should have watered up. I mean, all of us on camera don't do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know,
yeah.
It was really sad.
What can I say? The president did today... go to North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina. He visited a heavy-duty engine factory in Asheville, North Carolina. He wants to lower tax rates for manufacturers, special research and development tax credits to encourage more domestic investment. He also wants to, as he said, taxes back, if people reinvest taxes to the in the U.S. He wants to. It's very interesting. Last night, as you know, the president of Apple was there.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Jobs had met with the President Obama before he died, and President Obama said to him, well, when are Apple jobs come to the back to the United States? And Steve Jobs said never. But they are finding that because of our trained workforce, it's worth it for them to bring jobs back to the United States.
Sure. And not just our trained workforce, our infrastructure. Plus, the price of oil is a little higher, and it costs a lot more to ship things from China than to here than it did, you know, 5 years
right.
ago.
Right. So yes, there's a lot of things, and again, the president wants to do what they call insourcing on that. Speaking of oil, Robert Kennedy Jr. Was arrested today with his son, and with the climate activists outside the White House. They want to get the president to reject Keystone XL pipeline, and of course, that has come up as a huge kind of issue.
Yep, Daryl Hannah was arrested with them. She's going to be live on our program tomorrow.
Oh, that's great.
Tonight she'll be on the TV show. Yeah, And I guess she's going to be on the radio show tomorrow. She'll be here in the studio. So.
Okay. The White House said today, through Jay Carney, the spokesperson, that they expect Chuck Hagel to be confirmed, and that they say that they have 100% confidence in that. They also do in Jack Lew to be Treasury Secretary. So a lot of this is the press, they think, making up a story, and I think they're absolutely right about that. Then they got after the president. Well, in 2008, you said that there would be that you supported a $9.50 minimum wage yesterday, $9. Well, I got news for you, the economy is a little different than it was when he proposed it in 2008, but a lot of people are saying this should be tied, obviously, cost of living, inflation, that kind of thing.
If it had been tied to the cost of living in 1965, it would be $10.25 right now.
Exactly. And yeah. When I started and you started working, the minimum wage was $1.65 an hour.
Yep.
Pretty unbelievable. Also, the White House said that they were asked last night about the Rubio speech. They likened it they said it was essentially delivered by Governor Romney in terms of their policy essence, did not feel that Rubio had anything interesting to say. It is also interesting, the White House has said many times the reason the budget is not ready the first week in February, which it has traditionally been ready by and will be done sometime in March, is because, in fact, they want to make a budget that is not just something that's dead on arrival. They want to make a budget that takes into consideration the political realities. And I admire that. I think, you know, don't put a bunch of numbers on a page that you know are going to go nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Work with the people and figure out what's going to happen.
Right. Do you think that there's any possibility that the Republicans are rethinking their commitment to basically take down Obama by obstructing everything and that they might be willing to actually work with him in good faith?
I think you have some Republicans that realize they're never going to win an election in that kind of way. You know, so interesting. Somebody sent me Cousin Josh is, you know, doing his thing again in the great.
The guy who ran against Sherrod Brown, yeah, who's going to be with us in the next hour, in fact.
He wrote an op-ed saying, as opposed to his Republican governor, Kasich, that they ought not to do the Medicaid option. I mean, there are people like him that think they can run elections based on absolutely nothing, no negotiation, no political reality, no connection with the people of Ohio.
So your Cousin Josh, who just lost the election to Senator Sherrod Brown in Ohio, just came out and said that the state of Ohio should not take Medicaid funding for poor people at 100%. Doesn't cost the state a penny. Shouldn't take the money.
So this is, I think, the whole Medicaid option that that the governors are doing with the Affordable Health Care.
Right, that comes as part of Obamacare, right.
100%, I thought there was some state input on it. But
yeah, I think it's 100% for the first 3 years, and then it drops to 90% forever or something like
right.
that. But,
I mean, and yeah. He's saying they shouldn't do it. Even Governor Kasich, a known Republican, was on Fox News with me, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
He's saying they ought to take it. But
sure.
Not Cousin Josh. You have that party. It isn't going to change.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Give a crystal heart this Valentine's Day, made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Back with Senator Sherrod Brown after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's another... welcome back, by the way. 6 minutes past the hour. Another thing that really excited me in the President's State of the Union address last night. I have been saying for some time, you know, first of all, we have not been fighting a war in Afghanistan and Iraq. We've been staging an occupation. You fight wars against governments. We're occupying them. And the proof of this is that we can say... You know, a year and a half from now, this war is going to end. Do you really think that Eisenhower, when he was Supreme Allied Commander of European forces against Hitler, would have said, we're going to stop fighting Hitler on April 3rd of 1946? I don't think so. he would have said, we're going to stop fighting Hitler when we've totally kicked his ass, you know, from one end of Germany to the other. And so what this says to me, what this proves to me is that, this assertion that I've been making all along that this is an occupation and not a war is probably an accurate one. But I think it was a marvelous thing to hear the president say that he's pulling these troops out. We'll get back to that in just a minute. But right now, Senator Sherrod Brown is with us. His website, brown.senate.gov. You can check it out. And Senator Brown, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thank you, sir.
You issued, and thank you for joining us. In advance of the State of the Union, Senator Brown calls for creation of a national network for manufacturing innovation. You were talking before the State of the Union about what you were hoping to hear. I'm wondering now, the day after the State of the Union, if you heard anything close to what you were hoping to hear.
Yeah, we heard a lot of what we want. I mean, the president mentioned a pilot project that kind of came out of this area called the Tech Belt between Pittsburgh, kind of linking Pittsburgh, Youngstown, Akron, Cleveland, and what that means for manufacturing innovation. The Department of Defense, in conjunction with several universities and community colleges and local businesses and all, really see this as an example of how we can spawn manufacturing and sort of additive manufacturing, advanced manufacturing in different regions around the country. And the president wants to do 15 of these. This was the first. Congress needs to move on it. We're working with them to do that. And, you know, to create wealth, you either grow it, you make it, or you mine it. And making it has created the middle class in this country in so many ways.
Manufacturing it.
Yep.
Manufacturing is the essence of wealth. I've been throughout the show here, you know, playing clips of and going through this, through the president's speech last night. It was in many regards a progressive wish list. Excuse me. You're in the United States Senate. What is your take on the probability of any of these things? Raising the minimum wage, linking it to the cost of living, which, by the way, if it had been done in 1965, the minimum wage right now would be $10.15 an hour or thereabouts.
Exactly.
Which, and he pointed out, Romney agreed with him, using energy from public land to create an energy trust that could be used for green energy, acting on climate change, coming up with an economic plan rather than just blithering about the deficit, maintaining the full faith and credit of the United States, and we could, you know, whether or not that's the 14th Amendment, of all these things that he and one manufactured crisis to the next. Do you think that there is a possibility, a probability that the Republican group that met in the caucus room the night that the president was inaugurated 4 years ago and basically swore a blood oath to each other, including Paul Ryan, to obstruct his plans, you know, Mitch McConnell saying that his number one job was to prevent him from becoming a two-term president, that maybe there's some steam has been taken out of that and that the Republicans are going to collaborate with you guys?
Oh, I think there's no question that that steam has come out of that for them. I mean, they are in a period of great introspection. I was going to say great introspection. I'm not sure that some of my colleagues are quite capable of that, but they clearly are doing some self-examination of you know, what the future for their party. I mean, they've got the problem of African Americans are gone for at least a generation. Latinos, they continue, even if they pass an immigrant, some of them pass, are willing to vote for an immigration bill. You know, the kinds of racial, if not racist, comments that a number of them will be uttering in opposition to moving forward on it. Not to mention that immigration reform isn't going to turn Latinos back over to ever to the Republic in any time near future to the Republican Party. They got a problem there, and they got a terrible problem with young voters. So I think they are clearly concerned. That gives the president a couple of options. It gives them the option, I think, and he will do this for sure, to put pressure on them to adopt some of his programs that they might not be so thrilled with. But second, I think the president stated unequivocally that he will use his executive powers in every way they can figure out, whether it's on climate change, whether it's on election law, whether it's on job growth. And when, I know the Republicans, at least the far right, will call him a dictator and a socialist when he does that, but they're going to call him that anyway, and they already have. So I don't think the president has a lot to lose by really using the levers of executive power that some other presidents have used. And I hope he finds out creative legal ways to do it and move our agenda forward.
Well, and I think the important thing to remember is that an executive order cannot operate outside the boundaries of laws established by Congress. He can only direct agencies which have been established by Congress within the constraints of funding that has already been acknowledged or given by Congress, authorized by Congress, to behave in slightly different fashions within the boundaries that have been defined by Congress.
Exactly right, and the clean air stuff, the carbon, the climate change issues and mercury and other things those powers were given to the executive by the Congress some years ago. President Bush didn't choose to exercise them. President Obama will. And I think that's good news. And that's how this system of government works. And of course they're going to be critical of the president. They're going to be hysterical about some of the things he tries to do. But that's why we elected him. And to them, and I liked one thing the president said about sort of their economic policy. He said deficit reduction is not an economic policy, and it's certainly not a jobs policy. And that is sort of their only, that and tax cuts for the rich is sort of their only mantra.
Yeah. Now we have seen actually, a decrease in 600,000-700,000 government workers have been laid off, mostly by Republican governors and Republican states, some at the federal level, but have been laid off since President Obama first took office back 4 years ago. And we're also seeing the ongoing efforts by Republicans to slash government spending in other ways that would reduce employment. Is there any possibility that we're going to slide into another recession as a consequence of this?
There's I think likely not. I'm not an economist, but I think that there is that fear because you look at what not to do, and what not to do is the austerity policies of Europe, where Britain is falling into a second or a third recession, I guess, depending how they define it.
Yep.
But these austerity policies clearly violate what the great majority of economists would recommend. They just don't pass a straight face test. As you say, we've lost hundreds of thousands of public sector jobs. We've grown about 6 million private sector jobs since 2010. In my state, our unemployment rates dropped significantly, but it would drop significantly more if we did better with public sector workers that as you say, typically in most cases Republican governors and mayors and local executives have done. And
yeah.
it doesn't serve our purpose. I mean, you just can't cut your way into prosperity. You've got to grow your way. You look at the 1990s when we ended the decade with a large budget deficit. That was in large part because we had 21 million private sector job growth, net job growth during that decade.
Sure. Yeah, the fastest way to pay down a deficit is to increase employment and move people out of unemployment benefits and into paying taxes. Senator Sherrod Brown with us, brown.senate.gov is website. Senator, keep up the great work.
Thank you, Tom, and to you too for the good work you do. Thank you.
It is always an honor to have you on our program. We'll be back here on the Tom Hartman program, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And something Mitt Romney and Barack Obama agree on, I got to play you this clip, and as per Tom's request from Minnesota, the last paragraph of Obama's speech. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jerry, listening on WWRL in New York City, Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Well, on the President's State of the Union speech, and an otherwise, I thought it was an otherwise great State of the Union speech, where the president, even surprisingly and delightfully, as you pointed out, called for increasing the minimum wage and tying it to the cost of living.
Right.
But where I would share your criticism and critique is when we started out in the beginning of this show today, you were talking about where you would criticize the president is with respect to Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
And what particularly bothered me is where the president said on Medicare at one point that he's prepared to embrace the same reforms as those recommended by the Simpson-Bowles
Committee. No, he didn't say that. He said he was prepared to embrace the same outcome, which was basically there would be a balance, that it would help balance the budget. It would make the programs long-term stable.
Well,
I predict.
Well, Jay Carney was interviewed. Can I say that? Jay Carney was interviewed 3 hours before the State of the Union speech on Public TV's NewsHour program, and he did indicate that the president would be willing to put on the table both a change
CPI
with respect to Social Security and with respect to Medicare. The president would be willing to consider means testing the program, and in the past, the president has considered raising the eligibility age for Medicare. Well, this would destroy the program in the long run.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree. And in fact, he proposed means testing Medicare last night. He said, you know, let's adjust Medicare so that wealthy people are getting less of it, or words to that effect.
How do you define wealthy, though? You know where that's going.
I know. As soon as you take these things and you take them from an entitlement to a means-tested program, they become welfare programs, and then you start chopping away at them. And I will predict that you will see a chain CPI come out of this White House. It is going to be part of their grand compromise. And in fact, my sources tell me that the people in the White House actually think it's good public policy. The thing that I'm still scratching my head over and trying to figure out here is, you know, what the chain CPI chains to is behavior. Right now, the CPI says, here's a breadbasket full of goods. You know, here's gasoline and bread and steak and tires. And, did the price go up or down? And what a chain CPI would do is say, okay, are people still buying steak, or have they started buying hamburger because, you know, general income is going down? And so if they're buying hamburger, then that means the cost of living really hasn't gone up because they're getting the same nutrients, but they're paying less for it. So, you know, accurately described what the chain CPI does as standards of living are falling, as they have been doing for working class people and retired people ever since the Reagan administration. What a chain CPI does is it cuts the cost of living more rapidly than the price of inflation, It cuts into it. But what I'm still trying to roll around in my head, and I talked to two people today about this, two economists actually about this before I went on the air, and I'm not getting what are satisfactory answers to me, is with a chain CPI, during a time of economic expansion, wouldn't the process run in reverse? If everybody started making more money and they started saying, you know, instead of eating hamburger, I'm going to start eating steak, which is a lousy example for me to use as a vegetarian. But with a chain CPI, then the government would have to start accounting for steak, and all of a sudden you'd see an inflation in the price of steak, or, you know, in that piece of it, an increase, and that would increase the cost of living adjustment. And wouldn't, you know, if it's going to go down more than it should, when people's behavior shifts down, shouldn't it go up more than it should when their behavior shifts up? And
but can I say something?
Do you know the answer to that, Jerry?
Well, I know that the reason it's being proposed theoretically is to save the government money. I know that.
The reason being proposed, I mean, that's the way they think they can sell it to the Republicans. But the reason why, from what I'm hearing from people that I know who know people inside the White House, is that among some Democrats, in fact, who say that they think that the chain CPI is an okay thing, is because it's actually a more accurate measurement of what the actual cost of living is. Now, I don't agree with that so far, based on everything I know. And Bernie Sanders strongly does not agree with that. And Bernie is one of my, North Stars. If Bernie knows this stuff better than I do, and he's very worried about the chain CPI. But I still don't know what happens in an expanding economy, how the chain CPI doesn't turn into something that actually makes colas go up faster than they normally would.
But it's designed to make the colas go down in the short term. That's what it's designed to do. It's going to hurt the poorest beneficiaries.
Of course.
And I
agree.
That's why Senator Sanders is right to oppose this.
I agree.
Thing.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I am opposed to the chain CPI. Let me be on record, you know, as saying that. That said, given that it's probably going to happen, I think we should have a little better understanding of it. And I personally, like I said, I called two economists who are writing about this in the field today, and one of them said, I think that it's probably not going to go up as fast as it'll go down in terms of benefits. And the other one said, you know, no one's ever asked that question of me before. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. This is an economist who writes for publication here in Washington, D.C., with a major progressive think tank who has been writing about the chain CPI for a couple of years. And it's like nobody ever asked me that question. And I don't know the answer to it. And I want to find out. This may not be, you know, anything like, I mean, here's the good news, Jerry. If you had President Romney, they'd be figuring out how to turn Social Security over to Goldman Sachs. You know, to hell with the CPI. There wouldn't even be one. They'd be trying to figure out how to turn it over to Goldman Sachs. So, you know, I'm with you. I did not like when the president referenced basically means testing Medicare. And, you know, I am concerned that a chain CPI is coming. And if I was a betting man and I could bet on it over at Intrade, I would bet that it's going to happen, even though I don't want it. And I sure hope that if the president does give up that, if that's his bargaining chip, that he gets something really, really, really valuable in exchange for it. Because I understand, you know, horse trading. But let's hope it doesn't happen. And let's oppose it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's not just me. I mean, AARP opposes this, you know, which is arguably, you know, an insurance sales company. But still, you know, there's other groups that oppose it. There's a lot of people who oppose the chain CPI. The good, the bad, and the very, very recusantously ugly. The good. France. Yesterday, the French National Assembly voted to approve both marriage equality and same-sex adoption. While the vote isn't considered all that surprising, there was some chance that it wouldn't pass. The bill now goes to the French Senate, which is also likely to pass it. According to a recent poll, 63% of French voters support marriage equality. Should the bill pass the Senate and be signed into law, France would become the 12th or 13th nation to legally recognize same-sex marriage, as the United Kingdom is currently considering the same legislation as well. Isn't it time the United States added its name to that list? A majority of Americans actually approve marriage equality. It's time we got it done. The bad. Diana Medley. After word spread that a group of students was trying to make a gays-free prom at Sullivan High School in Indiana, Medley, a teacher at the school, went on an incredibly homophobic rant. In her comments, which have gone viral on the web, Medley argues that homosexuality is a choice and that homosexuals have no purpose in life. Since her ignorant and hate-filled comments went public, numerous groups have called for the school to discipline her. Many have even called for her to be fired. Fact is, we trust our nation's teachers to instill good in our children and to teach them to respect others and to become contributing members of society. Shame on Ms. Medley for teaching our children ignorance and hatred. And the very, very ugly Congressman Steve Stockman. Stockman was part of a betting pool yesterday run by a Texas conservative talk show host over what color Congresswoman Sheila Lee Jackson's outfit would be at the State of the Union. Just minutes before the speech started, Stockman tweeted, quote, "If you called purple in the Michael Berry Show Sheila outfit pool, you won." And as if his participation in the pool and his tweet weren't sexist enough, Stockman then went on to post a highly offensive comparison picture of Congresswoman Lee and Grimace, the large purple cartoon character from McDonald's commercials. So another day, another sexist remark coming out of the Republican Party. Let's hope the GOP's sexist streak stops soon, because it is very, very ugly. Boy, is that ugly. Okay. Kathy in Detroit. Hey, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to disagree with you on the CPI, the Consumer Price Index.
Well,
because our government changed those numbers.
Right.
And it does not include food and fuel. So those are the two biggest drivers that people go through, because they are both directly connected.
Yeah. Food, no, I'm of the opinion that the CPI, that
include food and fuel.
People can't hear me.
Where inflation really is.
I don't. Kathy, can you hear me?
It is escalating.
No, she can't hear me.
The Federal Reserve and their money printing.
Kathy, I think that you can hear me now, right?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Apparently, when people are talking, it mutes me, I guess, which is probably a good thing because I tend to interrupt too much. In any case, my personal opinion is that we shouldn't be talking about keeping the existing CPI or going to a chain CPI, but that there should be a separate consumer price index just for retirees, because retirees live very different lifestyles than average people, and there's this basket of 8 or 10,000 families that, you know, fill in these diaries and keep track of what they buy and how they behave and all this kind of stuff that's used to create the consumer price index. And that then is applied to Social Security. And I think that's wrong. I think the Social Security should have its own basket of things. Similarly, the CPI is used to calculate benefits for veterans. I think veterans' benefits, veterans have different needs than particularly disabled veterans, than do the average population. And so I think there should be a different CPI for them.
Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. It's hard because I've got like a delay on my phone here. But to me, it affects every American, no matter what your background. I know from our own personal family, you know, our costs have been going up. Our health care has gone up $2,500 in the last 2 years. Our gas here in my area, at least, it's about $378, and it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
So the CPI, which food and fuel, because fuel is what we need for our farmers to grow food, and food and fuel are directly, and it affects everybody.
No, I totally agree with you, Kathy. The rationale for the government taking those things out was that they were too volatile. I don't think that was the real reason, though. I think it was because they didn't want to have to, you know, they didn't want to have to pay the added
costs. To fool people, to make you think, like the Federal Reserve says, hey, we have inflation at about 3%. But if you look across the board, just 2012 alone, this is the government's own numbers, it's up 15% last year, 2012.
Yeah.
The real number. Yeah. The real number. The Fed is reporting, the bankers and the liars that run Washington and run Wall Street are trying to fool the American people. Just like the labor numbers. They say 7.8, but they're using the U3 number and not the U6, which is a more accurate indicator of the unemployment. Then when you get into the demographics and break it down within different areas, like within blacks, the African community, I know in Chicago they have a horrible
population. Unemployment is twice what it is. No, I'm totally with you, Kathy, and your point is very well made. Ben in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First time calling in. Just, I wanted to reference some stuff in the State of the Union address about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very glad to hear the president's remarks in the past few weeks about how he understands the risk and how climate change is currently happening. But I've got to say, to do this, he's got to get rid of that all of the above energy strategy mantra because it's just.
And they need to stop arresting people in front of the White House for protesting the Keystone XL pipeline.
Exactly, perfect example.
And in fact, we're going to have Daryl Hann on the TV show tonight. She'll be on the radio show tomorrow talking about that. She was arrested in front of the White House today. So yeah, I'm totally with you, Ben. And you know, the president says that he's practicing the art of the possible. I'd like to see it pushed. I'd like to see that envelope pushed. On the other hand, thank God it's not Mitt Romney in the White House. Gary in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Gary. Greed has no heart.
Tom Hartman. Tom.
Yes, sir.
I'm back. This is FDR.
Okay.
I can dream, can I?
Yeah.
You're right. Greed has no heart. And again, I was glad. I'm very glad to see the president address something that I've been ranting about, and others have been ranting about, the higher minimum wage with COLA.
Right.
I was glad to see you address it. That's a true progressive president. He had to come out and lead on this. He's been way behind on it.
Yeah, I agree, and he's taking flack from it and he is fighting back, which really, really pleases me. Thanks a lot, Gary, for the call, and thanks for your comment. Stephen in Los Angeles. Hey, Stephen, you share my opposition to a chain CPI.
Yes, right. I do, and I do. But you were speculating about how varying economic times might influence that chain CPI, and I'm aware of that. There's been some long-term projections, like over a period of 10 years, it's supposed to amount to a benefit cut of 3% over.
Right.
30 years and greater than 9%.
I've seen them, and I've got actually the formulas, and I sat down for about a half hour today with the actual formula, you know, going through the math with the variables inside the brackets, you know, and the whole thing. And it still looks to me like when you account I think it all depends on how you're defining accounting for behavior.
Is it behavior or substitution?
Substitution is behavior.
Oh, I thought that the powers that be say, well, you know, steak has gone up, but chicken has gone down. Eat chicken.
That's exactly right. That's exactly it. Chains.
Well, that's not me wanting to eat chicken. That's them telling me to eat chicken.
No, it's them saying that. Hang on just a second. I actually even have a little detail on this someplace here. I don't have it in front of me now because it was before the show and I was, no, I don't have it. But there's this 6,000-8,000, something like that, homes in the United States that fill out these diaries every couple of weeks. And, and after they fill out the diaries, you know, that information is used to then determine, the CPI. And the whole idea of the chain CPI is to say, okay, people aren't eating steak anymore; they're eating chicken. Chicken is less expensive, so there isn't inflation because people aren't spending more on food. So the question that I'm asking is, what's driving that behavior? If people are buying chicken rather than steak because it's cheaper, that means that people are having their standard of living decline, right? That's why they're moving to chicken. It's not because they prefer chicken. And I mean, it may be, but it's typically not. So the question in my mind is, what happens when prosperity returns? What happens if Obama actually can get progressive policies going? If the government was to become the employer of last resort, if the average wage was to go from, you know, whatever it is now to that plus half again, if we were to head back in the direction of the 60s and, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s and early 80s. And people started feeling prosperous, and they quit eating chicken, and they started eating steak again. Will that chain CPI then say, okay, people are now eating steak, which means that the cost of food has gone up, so we're going to raise up the cost of living, the COLA? And I have not gotten an answer to that. As I said, I asked two economists that question today, and one answer was ambiguous, and the other was, I don't know. So I'm still trying to learn it. Stephen, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Okay, and we're going to come back and talk about Steve Keen's comment on debt. Gary has some thoughts on that about private debt. Stick around. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And Gary at Allen Park, Michigan. Hey, Gary, you wanted to go back to my conversation with Steve Keen. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I was very fortunate to have heard that show and have read his book, Debunking Economics.
Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent critique of neoclassical economics, real eye-opener. And I think I'm happy to hear that the president wants to raise the minimum wage, but if he doesn't do things about personal debt, I don't care how much the minimum wage may be raised, we are still going to be in a terrible situation, and I don't see it necessarily getting any better.
Right, and there's a simple reason for this, and that is that as long as personal debt is high, when you raise people's wages, instead of spending that money, they will use it to pay down their debt. And,
exactly.
And so that's why what Steve Keen is saying is you got $1 trillion in student loan debt. Let's just wipe it out with a jubilee. If we can helicopter $1 trillion into Citibank and Goldman Sachs, we can helicopter $1 trillion into our student, you know, all of the students who are in debt. You've got $1 trillion in credit card debt out there. Let's wipe out a good chunk of that. You've got housing, you know, another couple trillion and a half of people who are underwater in their homes. Let's at least take them to par or par minus 20%, par minus a down payment, and basically have a debt jubilee.
And I think the other factor in that is that if you cause people to look at things in terms of debt, and they will, and it's not as available as it might otherwise be, then we will have, for example, with student debt, perhaps people funding education.
Right.
And since 1978, in the state of Michigan, 25% of the cost of education was covered, at least for higher education, was covered by tuition. 75% of it was provided, the funding was provided by the state.
Yeah.
Since 1978, it has now switched.
Yeah, federally the ratio used to be roughly 80-20, and now it's roughly 20-80.
Right.
I mean, or not federally, but I mean at a national level.
Right. And so where we are right now is in a position where if the president and, you know, the other people want to increase the minimum wage but not do anything about this, then we, I think, are in a position where we will just continually have problems and right. the economy is not necessarily going to pick
up. And here's the biggest problem about all that, Gary, and that is that all of that private debt, or the vast majority of that private debt, is held by for-profit banks. And those banks right. are making a very, very pretty penny on that private debt. They're making trillions every year on that private debt, or hundreds of billions, well, trillions. And right. the consequence of that is that they can easily afford to buy off enough politicians to make sure that Steve Keen's suggestion of eliminating that debt never happens. I mean, that's considered, you know, Jubilee is considered total pie in the sky, but they're also capable of making sure that our tax code doesn't get changed and our regulations of banking don't get changed in such ways that would allow people to even begin paying down that debt, because that debt is profitable to the banks. Our banks, you know, it was Thomas Jefferson, I believe, who said, "I fear banks more than a standing army." And you know, our maybe it was Washington, I don't know. Whoever it was. No, it was Napoleon. It was Napoleon who said, I fear bankers more than the standing army. And he was right.
And with good reason, particularly
yeah.
because during the colonial times, you know, Jefferson and Washington and the people who were in Virginia, who were planters in terms of tobacco, were in debt up to their ears.
Oh, sure.
To the British establishment. And, you know, I mean, it's ironic that the Tea Party sorts, as opposed to thinking about things from the standpoint of saying, look, part of what the Tea Party, the original Tea Party, the real Tea Party was concerned about, was helping the British East India Company at the expense of the citizenry, which was that he did not like the corporatist mercantile agenda of the, you know, Parliament and
mm-hmm.
the British government,
yeah.
as opposed to the idea that they were so concerned about taxes. There is a lot more to it.
So do you see, I don't see a way out of this other than waking up enough people to the fact that the private debt, this $38 trillion in private debt that we currently have in the United States, virtually all of which is held by banksters and on which they are making a nice profit continuously, that private debt is the real danger to our society. I don't see any way to bring about change other than waking up a lot of people, which is what I'm trying to do with this program. Do you have an alternative?
I think you're right. And, you know, although my wife and I would do anything if Bernie Sanders was to run for president.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. I mean, Bernie's quite happy being the senator from Vermont. And frankly, if he ran for president, the banks would come out and shoot him down. I mean, that is the problem,
right.
I don't mean literally shoot him down, but you know what I mean, is that
I understand.
Yeah, is that the banks have acquired so much power in this country. And until, well, we'll see. I mean, we've got a new Congress now. Elizabeth Warren is in the United States Senate. She's keeping her head down for the moment, although she's going to be on the Senate Banking Committee. And,
right.
you know, sometimes these things do take time, as much as it makes me crazy. I want it all now. But it took us
right.
32 years for Reaganomics to devastate this country and for 34 years. I mean, the deregulation arguably really began in the last 2 years of the Carter administration because
right.
he was imitating Maggie Thatcher in 1978. And thinking, oh, this is cool. Look at what she's doing. It's helping the UK. It would help the United States. So we got 34 years of, or 35 years now. It's 2013. We've got 34, 35 years of this insanity, and it's going to take more than one or two years to wring it out. In fact, I think it's going to take more than one presidential administration. And the main thing I think we have to do is work to get a House of Representatives that will work with this president and maintain Democratic control of the Senate in the next election 2 years from now. As much as I realize 2 years is a long way away, this is the big work that among other things, that we have to be doing. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. And, and thanks for reading Steve Keen's book. Good on you. Coming up tomorrow, it's a Thursday special Valentine's Day edition, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders talking about the issues of the week. Plus, geeky science rocks. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.